Today at Reader's Corner, David Goldfield, author of The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Millennials, baby boomers, Gen Xers, the greatest generation. Each designation conjures up ideas and preconceptions about the Americans born during those eras. But what is the gifted generation? That designation may be less familiar. It refers to Americans born in the years following World War II. They are the earliest, and historian David Goldfield would say, the most fortunate group of baby boomers. In his book, The Gifted Generation, Dr. Goldfield portrays this post-war era as a kind of golden age when the federal government took on a progressive, activist role to create the conditions in which people, even those from modest backgrounds, could succeed in ways their parents might not have imagined. His book details how this happened under the leadership of three visionary presidents, Harry S. Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Lyndon B. Johnson. These men often embraced ideas that went against their own parties and that were sometimes at odds with prevailing public opinion. But their actions expanded opportunities for an ever larger number of Americans. David Goldfield is the Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He is the lead author of the textbook The American Journey and the author of several works on Southern history, including Still Fighting the Civil War, Black and White, and Southern. Dr. Goldfield joins us today for this interview. David Goldfield, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, and it's good to be here, Bob.
Well, David, the subtitle of your book is what hooked me when I was in a bookstore one day, When Government Was Good. Why don't we start there? Help us understand what made government good in those days.
Government provided opportunities for young people in particular in the decades immediately following the Second World War. Opportunities in terms of supporting education, supporting research, ending discriminatory practices, both at the state and federal levels, and providing for an atmosphere that encouraged upward mobility and allowed young people, as you put it, of modest backgrounds to succeed not only in their careers, but in life as well.
Now, you came across this book, that is the idea of writing it, from a high school reunion. Tell us about Tilden High, a little bit about who your classmates were, the kinds of folks they were, and what they went on to do with their lives.
Yeah, in 2011, the 1961 class of Samuel J. Tilden High School in Brooklyn, of which I was a member, held its 50th class reunion. And two things in particular struck me about the friends and colleagues that I saw at that reunion. The first thing was that many of them had succeeded in jobs that did not exist in 1961. They made significant strides in a variety of work, from helping to discover the Intel processor, to opening up the first woman's bank in the U.S., to developing a rape kit that's now used by police departments all across the country and indeed the world, and many other innovations. And what really struck me about that, Bob, was that many of these fellow students came from very modest backgrounds. I suppose today you call them working class backgrounds. I was working class background. And yet there was upward mobility, which led me to the second revelation. And that is many of these classmates had received support from the federal government, either in terms of scholarships, research grants, the ability to end discrimination in both the college and university levels, as well as in jobs for women, for minorities, and for the sons and daughters of immigrants who made up the vast majority of students at Samuel J. Tilden High School.
And in many ways, this is some form of federal aid. For one thing, in those days, if someone was going to a state university, the tuition would certainly be a lot cheaper than it is today.
Right. I went to the University of Maryland, and my bill was $100 a semester. Mm-hmm. Even though that was a long time ago, I think most students could have afforded that. So what the federal government did was inspire the states to support higher education and also to provide opportunities. One thing that's very important here, Bob, is that the federal government did not guarantee results. The federal government provided opportunities, and we seized them. We took advantage of them and created not only prosperity for ourselves, but unprecedented prosperity for the United States.
Now, I think you also point out in your book that there were some Americans left behind in this period.
Yes, initially that was true in terms of African Americans, in terms of women, in some respects in terms of immigrants, particularly Catholic and Jewish immigrants, and the sons and daughters of those immigrants. These groups were not part of the American enterprise in a full way in 1945. But by 1965, 1970, the landscape had changed tremendously, particularly for the sons and daughters of the immigrants, for women, and the beginnings of the expansion of opportunities for African Americans and Hispanics.
Let's talk about Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson. At one point, you claim at the beginning of your book that really what these men stood for was the Commonwealth ideal. Help us understand that.
The Commonwealth ideal was a philosophy, an idea, and I don't think any of the presidents actually used that term. This is something I concocted with the help of Arthur Schlesinger, a great historian. The Commonwealth ideal meant that we're all in this together. To put it in vernacular terms, we're all in this together, and as the least of us succeeds, the entire Commonwealth will succeed. And when we develop public policy, we have to direct that public policy not toward the few, not toward the wealthy, but for all of us. And if we do that, the entire Commonwealth will benefit. And these three presidents who grew up and came of age during the Great Depression had service in the military and public service in political office. These three individuals had a very strong sense of what government could do. They came from very modest, and when I use the word modest, I'm probably gilding it a little bit. They were poor. Harry Truman's father couldn't really keep a job. His efforts at farming failed. The same with Lyndon B. Johnson's father, and pretty much the same with Dwight D. Eisenhower's father. Dwight D. Eisenhower's father, when President Eisenhower was born in Denison, Texas, wiped windshields on trains in Denison, Texas. So these were hardly silver spoon people. But because of the opportunities that government provided them, they realized that, hey, if this worked for us, maybe it can work for everybody in this country. And coming out of World War II, we realized that we would be a much stronger country, particularly concerning the Cold War with the Soviet Union. We would be a much stronger country if everybody were allowed to participate in the American enterprise.
So let's take Harry Truman. How do his accomplishments and initiatives, his agenda over the years, fit into this Commonwealth ideal?
Harry Truman, of course, was an accidental president. Many would say he was an accidental vice president, too. But he had this belief that the nation worked better if everybody could work and if everybody could fulfill their dreams and fulfill their capacities to the utmost. And he had a strong sense of fairness. He came from a Confederate background, yet he believed that African Americans should become full citizens of this country. And so he became the first president since the Civil War to support civil rights legislation. He also realized that it was unfair to limit immigration primarily to those countries of Northern and Western Europe, while ignoring the countries in Asia, particularly China, and also in Southern and Eastern Europe, where the predominant population was Roman Catholic and Jewish. And the feeling was in Congress and in the country at the time that these folks, from particularly from Southern and Eastern Europe, just would not fit in. They would bring disease. They would bring crime. In fact, you can recycle these arguments today. They would bring low education, and they would drag down the public sector in terms of their demands for funding. But he believed in fairness. In fact, he called his program the Fair Deal. And so he challenged these immigration laws unsuccessfully, just as he challenged civil rights unsuccessfully as well. So Truman's presidency, let's go down the list of things that he accomplished. Not that much. But in terms of health care, universal health care, in terms of immigration, in terms of civil rights, in terms of ending discrimination, particularly in higher education and in institutions that receive federal funds, he put these policies on the agenda and left it to future presidents, particularly Dwight D. Eisenhower, and even more particularly Lyndon B. Johnson, to implement.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with David Goldfield about The Gifted Generation. The book examines the role the federal government played in social and economic progress in the decades following World War II.
One of the things you point out about Eisenhower is that his singular accomplishment was espousing an activist government. There's something I don't hear from too many Republicans these days, not even recent presidents.
No, it's interesting. The Republican Party, like the Democratic Party in those days, was split. We really had a four-party political system. In the Democratic Party, you had the Southern white supremacist segregationists, and you had the primarily Northeastern and Midwestern sons and daughters of immigrants. It was a very odd coupling, to say the least. In the Republican Party, you had moderate Republicans, such as the Bush family, for example, in the Northeast and in the Plain States, some of them flaming liberals. And you had ultra-conservative individuals from the Midwest and the Far West. And what happened in Congress was that you tried to build coalitions across party lines because you really couldn't get a majority in most cases within a particular party. And it came to great fruition during the Lyndon B. Johnson administration because he was a master at building coalitions. But Eisenhower certainly did that as well. And he had a very internationalist perspective. And he believed, and he quoted this incessantly, and I memorized this because he quoted it so often. He quoted Abraham Lincoln saying that government must do for the people what the people cannot do for themselves or cannot do well for themselves. And he measured each of his policies with this dictum. And of course, the 1950s were very different from the 1860s when Lincoln first uttered this dictum. The 1950s, you had large corporations, you had the Cold War, and you had millions of servicemen returning from war. And you had African Americans and the sons and daughters of immigrants knocking at the door of American opportunity.
So how'd JFK get moved to the side in this argument about the Commonwealth ideal and these three presidents? You decided not to include him in the same way you did the other three.
That's correct. My chapter on JFK is called Interlude, meaning the time between the end of the Eisenhower administration in January 1961 and the beginning of the Johnson administration, which tragically began as a result of Kennedy's assassination in November of 1963. Kennedy was a magnificent speaker. He had these wonderful ideals. But when it came down to implementing public policy, Kennedy just didn't do it. For one thing, he always had his eye on the 1964 presidential race. He wanted to be reelected. And in order to do this, he had to mollify the southern wing of the Democratic Party. Again, this was the segregationist wing. So he would not move on civil rights. He would not move on much during his first term because he wanted this support. And in fact, he begged Lyndon Johnson, against Lyndon Johnson's advice, by the way, to join him on a trip to Dallas, Texas in November of 1963 to shore up support for his candidacy, for Kennedy's candidacy in the 1964 presidential election. And of course, we all know what happened in November of 1963. So Kennedy had these marvelous ideals, and he had also very good ideas. And in fact, what Lyndon Johnson did when he became president was implement the Civil Rights Act, work on environmental protection, work on immigration, and work on ending job discrimination. All of these initiatives had appeared on the agenda of JFK during his years in office, but he was very cautious, extremely cautious in moving them to the point where they could become legislation.
So let's talk a little bit about Nixon, and I'm fascinated by the way you treat Nixon, and it doesn't surprise me any, but we associate him with Watergate and an erosion of trust in government, but he also is connected to the Commonwealth ideal to some extent. As a matter of fact, you quote the late Theodore Lowy, a political scientist whose text I've used in my own classes over the years, as saying Nixon was the last Democratic president of the 20th century. I thought that was a great line to bring up from Lowy's past. Help us understand that.
Lowy, I think, was only being half facetious when he said that.
Right.
But Richard Nixon, you're absolutely right. We remember him for Watergate, remember him for his illegal antics in the White House. But what Nixon did, for just to give you a few very brief examples, one, more public housing was constructed during the Nixon administration, during his first term, than in any of the previous presidencies. So he was very concerned about developing African-Americans as contributing citizens, about supporting Black enterprise at a time when this was not only not common, but it was not a particularly popular idea. Secondly, Nixon always said that when he talked about his legacy, he said, "I want to be known as the environmental president." And he started the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970 and promoted environmental legislation, quite different from the Republican Party today. Whether he believed in global warming or not, who knows? But he recognized that the environment of this country and the world in general was finite and that it was under assault, and that he had the opportunity not only to stem that assault, but perhaps to reverse the degradation of the environment. And he went at it completely. Also, I think Nixon is not given much credit in terms of what he did in social welfare. The idea that everyone should have an income, which is now being recirculated, the idea that individuals and particularly families, he was very concerned about supporting families. You know, we talk about family values, and that is a Republican Party bedrock, at least it was back in the 1960s and 1970s. And Nixon tried to do this with his family assistance plan. It didn't work. He couldn't get support in the Congress for it. But it was an idea whose time was not yet here. And in fact, many of the ideas brought up by Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson in particular still are awaiting implementation, such as paid family leave, such as universal child care, such as universal health care. All of these ideas were floated during the Truman administration, and subsequent administrations tried to implement at least part of these proposals, but we're still a long way from European and Asian countries in implementing these programs.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is historian David Goldfield, author of The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. Well, your subtitle pretty much gives away the fact that you're talking about the past and not the current situation we face in America today and for the last few years, as a matter of fact. And you cite Reagan as perhaps the president that made the difference here and may started us off on a different course. I might add, by the way, that in those early Reagan years, I was teaching at the University of Illinois, and I taught the basic American government class, among others. And I could see from 1980 right on through his second term the change in students' attitude about government. You couldn't turn TV on without Reagan saying something about government isn't the solution, it's the problem. And it doesn't take long for that to embed itself in the culture. And you seem to be saying that that's where we may have turned the corner.
You're absolutely right, Bob. This was the turning point, the Reagan administration. He never appreciated the irony of trashing a government over which he presided. And he did everything to accomplish two objectives. The first objective was to dismantle the regulatory state. That is the regulatory state that protected consumers, that reined in financial institutions, and that protected the environment. You may recall that one of his earliest appointments was Ann Gorsuch Burford for the Environmental Protection Agency. Her son, of course, is Neil Gorsuch, currently conservative justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. So he tried to deregulate what the previous administrations in the 25 years after World War II had developed to protect Americans. The idea, the Commonwealth idea, was that there would be a balance between corporate America, between individuals and the government, and that the government would sort of be the umpire in this respect. But Ronald Reagan did not believe in the level playing field, which brings up the second objective of Ronald Reagan, and that is to skew public policy, not to destroy government altogether, but rather to direct it to favor the extremely well-connected, the extremely wealthy individuals. And that is the system that we have inherited today. And I must say, though, that it's unfair to blame all of this on Ronald Reagan, because the Democrats were complicitous in this as well. As far back as the 1972 presidential election, which was a debacle for George McGovern and the Democrats, young Democrats, particularly Gary Hart of Colorado and Bill Clinton of Arkansas, got together and decided, hey, look, we've really got to do something here. And they decided to go after the rising professional class to appeal policies to them. Well, what has happened is that who speaks up for the common man? Who speaks up for people like myself, kids growing up in Brooklyn in the 1940s and 1950s? Who speaks for the working class? Black or white, black and white. And the fact is, neither political party really addresses the issues that are important for the average American. So Ronald Reagan, his significance was twofold. First, in limiting government. And in fact, Bill Clinton in 1996 said the era of big government is over. Well, he was about 20 years too late in that. But basically, his policies were in terms of welfare, in terms of uncoupling the Glass-Steagall Act for financial institutions. If you look at Clinton's policies, it's sort of Republican light. And we get into George W. Bush, of course, reinforced these policies combined with disastrous foreign policy. And President Barack Obama, although, again, like Kennedy, he talked a great game, he really did not follow through. So here we are in 2018 with the result of this neglect of basic American values of the American people in favor of a favored few. And I conclude the book, believe it or not, Bob, I conclude the book on an optimistic note. My optimism is that, hey, we've been here before in the years following World War II. We've been here before. We have the policy blueprint to get us out of this, to bring government back into our lives in a positive way, to end the inequality, to end the skewing access to government, to provide support for all of our people, and therefore to build a good and better and great nation.
Well, you've certainly highlighted the growing gap that we all know exists between the haves and the have-nots today. The income equality issue alone is one that has really helped inspire, it appears, this new populism. And I wonder if you could share with us your thoughts on the Sanders approach to populism and the Trump approach to populism. Obviously, they're very different, but in the 2016 campaign, they were front and center in the campaign conversation.
I call Trump's populism faux populism, in the sense that if you look at his policies to date, it really don't benefit the Commonwealth. Again, they benefit a relatively narrow stream of supporters. Take the tax cut, for example. Yeah, middle class got a few hundred dollars, maybe a few hundred dollars a month out of it, but the big tax cuts went to the extremely wealthy. In terms of tariffs and trade wars, nobody wins trade wars. And the people who are going to be hurt the most are average Americans. Either they're going to pay a lot more for consumer goods, or they're going to lose their jobs because factories and suppliers can't get reasonably priced goods from countries that now have a high tariff or tax attached to their imports. And in terms of the environmental policies as well, they benefit the big oil interests, the big natural gas interests. They don't benefit people. I mean, have you seen the rapid decline in gas prices? No, you haven't, because, again, these policies tend to favor the very few. Now, in terms of Bernie Sanders, I think that's probably closer to the Commonwealth ideal. But at the same time, one of the aspects of the Commonwealth ideal was that we try to get along with each other, that we try to develop a system of compromise, because our government governs best from the center. And the greatest legislation that we have had, from civil rights to the environment, always occurred by compromising toward the center. And I'm wondering if a scorched earth populism that Bernie Sanders advocates, I'm wondering if that's a realistic way to govern. Certainly the ideas are great. The universal health insurance, which Harry Truman first promoted, God, 60, 70 years ago. I think these are laudable goals to work for. And I think Barack Obama, to his credit, viewed the Affordable Care Act as a step toward Truman's ideal. And the way our system of government works, I think we have to do it incrementally and not in a way that is going to further polarize Americans. We need a leader who will be able to bring all of us together again, not necessarily loving each other or necessarily agreeing with each other, but at least working for the common good. And I believe that since we have done this in the past, we have this blueprint, and the blueprint exists in the lives of my fellow Tilden High School alums, and I talk about those lives in the book, and in the presidencies of Truman, Eisenhower, and Lyndon B. Johnson.
David, a half an hour does not do justice to your book, which is The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. But it's all we have right now. Our listeners, of course, can get out, buy a copy of this book, and fill in the details, because there's so much we weren't able to cover. But I must say that for me, it was a great refresher of recent American history, putting it in the context of where we are today and how we got here. I want to thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it.
Next week, my guest is Lisa Servan, author of The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Anna Webb. Our producer is Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. And you'll find links on how to contact us on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.